It's four chapters. No, I can't read that fast, so we're gonna kind of skim over. And there's a couple things that I want to point out before we get going. We have been previously in Judges, previously in some stories that everybody learns as a kid, whether it was Samson or all these things. But up to this point, there's a commonality in all of those. And God is very present. God is very prevalent. And by that, I mean there's the judges usually are seeing visions from God, or speaking to the holy angel, or something. They're hearing the voice of God. When they're led out of Egypt, they're following a cloud, and Moses is always in the tent of meeting, talking to God. When he goes up on the mountain, it's to talk with, to speak with God. And so up to this point, we kind of have this, as a young person who, maybe even old, I'm still at that point, but who just wishes, man, I wish he would just come down and talk to me, right? Oh, they had it easy in the Old Testament. It would be a whole lot easier to believe if we were walking behind a pillar of fire. Like, those are thoughts that I think are pretty common. As anybody, especially folks who are just getting into it, who are following God. And what I want us to realize here, and this might blow all of us away, there is no text in Ruth that says God came down, God spoke through a vision, God did this, God did that. Ruth is a very, I mean, it's as life as, obviously it looks a little bit different because of the time period, but overall, Ruth is speaking into our day-to-day lives. I'm a big fan of repetition, and this is a story that is placed and breaks repetition. And so when that happens, I also believe that we should be attentive to why that is. And I think Ruth is oftentimes an overlooked book, but it's also, again, it's speaking to us day to day about a woman, two women, that are going through an incredibly hard time. And God works through that, but not in the way that we're accustomed to reading about in the Old Testament. Not in a way that these big things happen or that's incredibly visible. Gonna be incredibly honest, I was not privy to or as appreciative of Ruth until this past week. It was something that I skimmed over frequently because I didn't realize how important of a break this is. So I want to actually read the first verse because this is giving us our time frame and our context, because we just went through some incredibly difficult to read things through Judges, and see how judgment was brought in various ways and how somebody interceded or brought the people back into a time of peace. And so in Ruth 1, and this is always something that I need to do, is read the Bible chronologically. I have not done that yet, so I will do that this year. But this gives us a good hint into the time period. In the days when the judges ruled. So, if we can rewind just a couple, even a week ago, is this a good time period for the Israelites? No. We have a vicious cycle of them falling away of people who get brought out of a dire circumstance when God hears their plea. And again, our memory verse, and I love it for this, even this story in Ruth, when the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. That's Psalms 34, 17 through 18. And so we see that very prevalent throughout Judges, the cry of the people when they're being oppressed, and God sends somebody to bring them out of this oppression. And then what does it say? Again, Israel was doing things that were bad in the sight of the Lord. We have that over and over and over throughout Judges. And so what this is doing from the get-go is setting the place and time where this story happens. Who's familiar with Ruth in here? Couple. Like I said, I had a little appreciation for this book until I started looking deeper into it and seeing how much it probably talks to our day-to-day life as we see it. So in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, and one named Orpah, and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. So we get this kind of dire picture that nobody wants to be in, right? It's setting up in a bad time period and a bad circumstance. There's little light to look on at this moment in time. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could be your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand is turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. Where they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." kind of a dire text, right? And what I started this whole unit with is I want us to think about the Messiah. Because even in this story, we're going to have some glimpses of a Messiah. And I'm going to not read as much so that I won't get buzzed by the bell. Caleb, I guess, is already making fun of me today for going long. We went and talked to the high school the other day, and I went long again, so I kept them from class, which I thought was a good thing, but some people might not have. So we have this dire circumstance, famine. They lost their husbands. Naomi lost her sons and her husband. She's alone, and Ruth follows her and says, and this is what I want to point out. Ruth is where is she from? She's a Moabite. Right? So it's not, and this is, I want to point this out because we're about, in chapter 4 of Ruth, we get into genealogy, everybody's favorite. But this is it's either great-grandparent or grandparent of David, the king. Mom's shaking her head. Is it great or grand? Great, okay. So, lineage of Christ. A Moabite woman who sticks with her mother-in-law, which I'm not sure how many of us would want to do that in here, right? I got a chuckle from the back corner. I'm not going to say who. Yeah, I can kind of push buttons. Mine's downstairs. Hopefully this isn't recorded, right? But she's set in this impossible place, this impossible circumstance, and I want us to reflect partially back on what it says up front, is in the land of Israel, God provided food during the famine. So there's already recognition that God is providing in their land. So why'd they flee in the first place? Famine. Why are they going back? Because God provided. So there's a recognition already. It didn't say then the lands of Israel became fertile and they started to grow. It said God provided food. Whatever way that was, we're not quite sure, but it said God provided food. So they go back and it kind of creates this buzz, right? That this lady who left came back and now she's without husband, sons, and she's with her daughter-in-law. So there's a buzz that's stirred. This Moabite woman comes back. And then hopefully we're going to paraphrase some of the rest of this story. But after this, they go and they're allowed to glean the fields, right? The sojourners or immigrants would, and again, Naomi is not an immigrant. Naomi's an Israelite, but they're coming back to live as immigrants. They're going through and they're gleaning the fields. After a field is picked over, the immigrants are allowed, and this is a Levitical command of generosity, is that they're supposed to leave a portion for the immigrants to come so that they have food. So we're in this process and we see them living like this, and her Boaz, a distant relative of Naomi, but questions Ruth in the field, and so starts to learn who she is. And then we go through this process. And I want us to, some of you might know, but this is an incredibly key word that I want us to look at in this story. It's actually on the front pages of y'all's little books here. But Boaz is a redeemer. Christ the Redeemer. Boaz is a redeemer, and we learn And again, man, time does fly when you're having fun, right? Again, he's not first in line. There's somebody that's before him. And Ruth comes to Boaz and pretty much says, redeem me. You've been good to me. I've been faithful. I've been loyal. And it says that Boaz knows Naomi's character. The other guy didn't want to redeem a Moabite woman. Boaz knows Naomi's character, and they go through the redemption process, which the process is that they take the land and then redeems the wife. So Boaz redeems Naomi. And so out of this picture of, in another important part is to be in the line of the king, they needed what? Offspring. That's exciting. Because I know maybe not today's times, for a lot of folks it is. That's exciting. That was a blessing from the beginning of time, is be fruitful and multiply. When women are barren, they're typically praying for offspring. We see this also repetitiously. And Ruth comes without kids, without husband. She's been married. And pretty much that means, I mean, you got, if there's not a redeemer, you are alone and gone. Like, you're outcast. You're just going to glean the fields for the rest of your life. Kind of sounds like a Messiah, right? If Boaz wasn't here to redeem, she'd be gleaning the fields for the rest of her life. And so we start to build this picture. And when they come together, guess what? And Boaz is presented as a faithful, upright man. And Naomi is also, or not Naomi, but Ruth is also presented. There's spoken about similarly. The words used to describe them are similar. And so we have this picture, and then he goes to the elders and he says, hey, he finds the guy who's next in line and says, hey, there's a Moabite woman that you're called to redeem. And he said, no, that's going to mess with my inheritance. Right? I'm gonna pass on my responsibility, because that's going to affect my inheritance. And then Boaz comes through with his promise and the word that he gave Naomi that he would redeem her, and he does just that. And the blessings talked about, and I've been all on blessing lately, because next week I'll be preaching too, so that's a forewarning if some of y'all don't want to show up and listen. But we're talking about blessing, and blessing is through God, only God. God has the power to bless, not us. So Boaz is, I'm going to find this verse real quick, just because I think it's important, because you see the reflection of Boaz's character to a large extent. Going to be in chapter 3 real quick. I'm flipping. It might be 4. It's actually chapter 4. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here, and they did so. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of the seated here, in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so, but if so, if you will not, tell me so I know, for no one has the right to do it except for you. And I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, on the day that you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the guardian redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because it might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was a method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself." And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witness that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I also have acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witness." Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witness. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem, though the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman. May your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." Pretty bold words, right? And again, I want to present this as a blessing, because this is not timid words. Through the offspring the Lord gives you. Does it say hopefully? It says, "Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." Who remembers who Tamar is? She's the lady that tricked Judah into sleeping with her after Judah didn't bring his next in line son to marry her, who is also in the lineage of Christ. It's kind of an odd parallel, right? There's a lot of people he could have said. It starts with Rachel and Leah, who built Israel through their offsprings, through their kids. And then we go down, and it says, "Be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." And again, we're going to end with genealogy. It's genealogy of David. It's 4:18. "Then this is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David." Again, in our Messiah comparisons, I want us to realize that these people down and without, and Kevin's going through the Sermon on the Mount, but this story is incredibly indicative of what Christ says later on. He says, "Blessed are those," pretty much, "who are without, who are neglected, who are afflicted. Blessed are those people." Right now we're reading about those people who lost spouses, who lost sons, who lost all these things, and God brings them in, and through one man who is called a redeemer, brings these people out of certain poverty, provides for them, and puts them in the lineage of Christ. That's a pretty incredible story. I don't want to overspill a lot of beans because I'm excited for the Sermon on the Mount. So I am going to open it up to statements, questions. I've got like 5 or 3 minutes till the first bell. Unless somebody asks a tough question, we're going to be in good time here. Is there any statements, anything that stood out to y'all? Again, we didn't read a lot of it. We read a couple glimpses. But this is, and I didn't probably do a good enough job in the time I had to re-point out that this is our first story, or the first book of the Bible, that hopefully us sitting here relate heavily to. Because there wasn't angels in appearance that are coming down and telling Ruth that she's going to have offspring. There's no sign from God, the grand sign from God that's saying, hey, Ruth, Naomi, go down to this place and somebody will redeem you. Go back to Bethlehem. Go back to your homeland and somebody's going to bring you out and redeem you. They go off of the premise of, hey, God has provided food here. They're going out of survival, and God provides so much more. This is a story that we can actually relate to because it's indicative of, does anybody ever ask if God is prevalent and present in just our day-to-day? Hopefully we realize instances that he is, but sometimes it's kind of hard, right? This is a story about God being prevalent and present in day-to-day. Not through visions or miracles or signs, just a woman living life that God takes care of. And their glory does go to God. That's the important thing. In our day-to-day, it's oftentimes easy to get tangled up in, does God really care about, does God really? Well, our memory verse should answer that, first of all. But second of all, this is probably the best example of somebody just living life in pursuit of God and God taking excellent care of them. Again, memory verse, when righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. In her heart is for the afflicted. Like, could she have gone back home like her sister-in-law? And that's what Naomi pushes her to do. It's better for you to do this. And her heart went out to the afflicted and her mother-in-law that's lost two sons and a husband in short time. And so, yes, and again, one of the best verses, I was ready for it that time. One of the best verses is, your God, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Because again, she's outside looking in. I imagine as somebody out, we read these stories, of Ruth, of, why am I spacing? The prostitute in Jericho. Rahab. You read all these stories of people on the outside looking in, it's probably intimidating. God's chosen people. In the story of Rahab, it's God's chosen people called to come crush the town and the people that she's living in. It's probably, and I do want to point that out because, guys, oftentimes people are no less intimidated on the outside looking in. If you didn't grow up with this shelf in your brain for God, it's something that's hard to wrap our minds around. And Ruth is a Moabite, probably grew up around some ungodly stuff. And her shelf that she has on is not for God, it's for gods. It's for sacrifice. It's for a lot of festivals that aren't by any means godly. It's for a lot of junk. That's her shelf, is filled with junk. So to follow Naomi and say, your God will be my God. I love how she, because oftentimes you see people with a small point of recognition and said, your gods, or your, when you're talking to Pharaoh, and he's like, he doesn't grasp but that there is one God, the Almighty God. And through Ruth's presentation, she grasps that there is one God, an Almighty God, the God. And oftentimes when we see these, you come face to face with God, you have a decision moment. Some people decide to follow God or to let God work. If we think about the story of Joseph, the Pharaoh, Joseph interprets the dream and he's like, truly your God is the God. And he lets him work and he gives him the best of the land. When he brings his whole family, he gives them Gishon, is supposedly great fields for your flocks and all this stuff. And when the next guy in line comes in and things start to fall apart. And then the next guy is the Pharaoh we read about. Or not the next guy, but shortly after there, the Pharaoh that we read about, that Moses gives him signs and stuff that nobody else can do, but he refuses to acknowledge who God is. Yeah, if we were on the opposite side of God and being team captains and we got to pick who, we'd have that real screwed up. And we'd be like, what is this guy doing? Has he never played basketball before? Like, doesn't he know who that is? We would probably be in a muddy mess. Saying they just... they just don't get it, right? And so we get these stories, and it is, I love the genealogy of Christ. It is one of the most interesting, intriguing things. Because also you have Jews that don't recognize who Christ is. But it's their genealogy that they had. I am going to go long. You got me. You can laugh. When you have this picture of the genealogy of Christ, there's a lot of people that we can pick out. Well, guys, they had this. When I was reading Ruth, I was like, what is the importance of the book of Ruth? Like, it's in here for a reason. I read the story, and you're kind of like, okay. And then I started to really break it down, and I'm like, well, there's genealogy, which is incredibly important for the Jews, as well as us, to know who Christ came through, because that was the prophesied Messiah. And also what I talked about with with it being a more normalized story of how we live life, our day-to-day life, and just prayers and thoughts instead of these big signs and miracles. But when we're just going through the lineage of Christ and we're reading Ruth, I think there's a lot of importance, because when Christ comes, he opens God to everybody. Christ, over and over, is picking his lineage out of not his chosen people, per se. They're obviously chosen because they're in the line of Christ, but as a Jew would look at a chosen person, he's picking a Moabite woman. He's picking Rahab. Like, there's a lot of people that weren't just born into it. This has been a presentation. The Messiah has been a presentation. What this is supposed to look like has been a presentation from the very beginning. Who God chose is very, very indicative of God's plans that we're hopefully going to read about for the rest of how, I don't know, is this 4 years? For 4 years. We're going to be unfolding, and I'm not saying that I'm going to be up here for 4 years. Y'all can fire me whenever you want. But for 4 years, we're going to hopefully unfold God's intent and purpose and his plan. And it's going to be hopefully mind-blowing to see who he chooses to do that through. Because he has some questionable picks in his lineup. He's picking the 5'2" kid that can't shoot. And there's a 7-footer that can dunk on the other side, right? So thank y'all for being here. If you haven't read Ruth, I know we had to kind of skim over it, but it is an incredible story that very much showcases our day-to-day lives, and that God is intentional, not just through signs and miracles, but in our day-to-day. All right, he's ringing the bell twice on me. Thank y'all.